Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in-depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more discussing important topics in higher education, student life, and research. I'm Derek Smith, and our guests today are Baylor professors Stephen Trumbull and Sasha Yusinko. Dr. Trumbull and Dr. Yusinko are the researchers behind groundbreaking studies, gleaning insight through the examination of whale earwax. Trumbull and Yusinko pioneered a technique for reconstructing information about pollutants and man-made stressors and their impact on baleen whales in a groundbreaking 2013 study, and followed it up this year with a study reconstructing baleen whales' lifetime stress response to whaling and other man-made and environmental factors spanning nearly 150 years. Their research was published in Nature Communications and has been covered by NPR, The Atlantic, The Smithsonian, and a wide array of high-profile news and science outlets and organizations. Dr. Trumbull, an associate professor of biology, director of the Laboratory of Ecological and Adaptational Physiology at Baylor, spent 2 months in Antarctica last spring studying leopard seals, a top predator in the region. Dr. Yusinko is the director of the Yusinko Environmental Chemistry Lab at Baylor, where his research group focuses on environmental quality and health through the study of chemical transport, fate, and distribution in complex environmental systems. Dr. Trumbull and Dr. Yusinko are with us today on the program. Welcome. It's great to have you guys here with us.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, you guys do a lot of these interviews and talks, and I'm sure a question you get a lot, and that's the one I'll start out with, is whale earwax. Why whale earwax, and when did you begin to realize it could be a treasure trove of information?
So, a number of years ago, very serendipitous, we had this idea, Sasha and I were talking about how do you age a particular whale, baleen whale, and there are a number of ways to do this. And we said, whale earplug is one of the ways. And we ended up, by kind of a little tier of colleagues working with the Smithsonian and working with us doing some other work, getting a whale earplug sent to us from the Smithsonian. And we knew that this was an aging proxy. We knew that these whale earplugs could be used to and they have been for about the last century used as a way to age these animals. And with Sasha's background in like sediment core chemistry.
Yeah, chemical reconstruction.
And my kind of background in hormones and marine mammals. And we just kind of had this idea that this might work. And we contacted Smithsonian. They sent us a plug. And it's kind of taken off from there.
You've talked about, I think I've seen the analogy, when you talk about aging whales through their wax, are there little ticks along the way, sort of like a tree and its rings that give you those clues?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's they're laid down, and there's like this light and dark pattern throughout the life of the animal. I mean, they extrude earwax throughout their whole life. There's nowhere for it to go. It's just kind of hanging out in near the base of the brain there, off to the side, it takes some doing to get these earplugs out, but yes, I mean, the whalers used to pull the plug out and they'd cut it in half, count the rings, and kind of basically have an age. And to their credit, museums have collected these throughout the decades and stored them.
Obviously, I think there's a curiosity and intrigue factor when you're talking about something like whale earwax. So could you describe that for us? What does it look like and feel like, and how does it tell a story?
Well, I mean, so there's a number of baleen whale species that have earwax plugs, or this accumulation of wax over their lifetime. And different species have actually, different types of plugs. And so we've actually, over time, gotten pretty good at a distance looking at a plug and being like, oh, that's a fin whale or that's a blue whale. For fins and blues, they're pretty rigid. They kind of, to me, feel like a combination of wet wood and gross candle. kind of combination. And then we had the privilege of working with a bowhead earplug, which was over 50 centimeters in length, so just a really substantial mass. And that was much more gelatin in kind of nature, that turkey gravy, solidified turkey gravy gelatin, if that's a holiday kind of
good analogy.
Analogy
yes,
there.
For this time of year.
So they can be quite different, but for the most part, they're – they're unique matrix in their own. And for analytically speaking, they can have some enormous challenges just because they have so much complex matrix that interferes with our ability to make analytical measurements. So there's a lot of challenges to work with that.
Now, you said you can determine the age through these, but you all in your study in 2013 and certainly now have realized that there are other stories that can be told through the earwax. What are some of those stories? And we'll use that as a springboard into that groundbreaking 2013 study.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, we knew that, you know, lipophilic compounds are probably going to be attracted to this matrix, right? And so anything that would kind of adhere to fats, we figured we might be able to find this, right? And so we started looking these layers, and then we look at hormones, and which was really nice because they're basically kind of labile, meaning that they kind of break down and they leave the body pretty quickly. But they were actually they were kind of stored in these each layer. And then from that, Sasha was like, well, let's look for contaminants. And sure enough, we found contaminants. And then let's look for, we do stable isotopes. And then we just start putting these stories together. We have basically a lifetime profile of, let's say, stress hormones. Then we can do the lifetime profile of contaminants. We can do the lifetime profile of isotopes. And we put it together, laying on top of each other. And that gives us some sort of a story of each particular animal, right? And they're all different. I mean, just like we are. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing with this is we can sort of take and make a baseline for that particular animal. And that's going to show for that particular animal, does this impact more than this, or does this? And then we have the story. And because we baseline corrected for this animal, and now we'll do all the animals, and then we can compare them with each other and see if there's patterns that show up in nature, if there are things that's, impacting them as a group.
In my mind, I kind of think about each chemical or each measure we're making, it is linked to something. We actually have been very specific about what we choose for that. So if I think about an historic pesticide, that's obviously going to be related to historical agricultural activities. If I think about cortisol, which is the marker for stress in the animal, then it's obviously going to be representative of stress. For the stable isotopes for carbon and nitrogen, that gives us concepts of foraging or dietary behavior. And so there can be stress with diets. There can be stress with contaminants. And so we started to match up both the stress data with our stressor data. And that allows us to piece together this life history. And so there's also natural stresses occurring with things like when you reach sexual maturity. For pregnancies and females, that's obviously going to be a stressful scenario. So there's even some natural stress points in there. But the earwax itself is similar to other matrices, and it has two key things. It has the chronology associated with it, or some way that we can do a time estimate or to have a time series with each layer. And the other key factor it has is it has ability to record and archive these chemical tracers or these molecular markers. And then what we've done is developed techniques to go back, make individual measurements, and combine the analytical measurements with the age estimates. And that allows us to reconstruct the life history. What Steve is bringing up that was so important is that a lot of marine mammal work is they're taking a biopsy, a glimpse in time for that life. And what we're finding is that some of the, kind of common knowledge about whales, where they migrate from and stability in food webs and some of those type of things are maybe kind of a little bit
wrong.
They're pretty wrong. The amount of variability that we see, the individuality that we see is actually quite impressive. And so taking a single biopsy of a whale is maybe not the most cost-effective and maybe difficult to translate that data into meaningful science or the level of scientific findings that we can get out of an earplug because we can correct it back to the whole lifespan of that individual.
It's almost like you're examining a community of sorts to get that whole picture of what everyone, how they experience an event.
Yep.
Makes sense. That's good. When was the aha moment for you all? And then also from that standpoint, what's that rabbit trail chasing that been like as you started realizing here's the data we have and we can compare it to historical data? What's that process like? Because it combines a number of kind of different disciplines there.
Well, yeah. So the aha moment, I mean, it kind of goes in stages, right? We had this idea. We're actually walking to get a coffee one day, right? And we kind of looked at each other like, this could work. It was pretty fast the way and pretty quick the way I said, yeah, listen, we can get hormones out of this thing. And hormones are great. We can do reproductive hormones. We can do stress hormones. but we needed the stressor, right? And Sasha was doing the contaminant work, and so trial and error, and he was doing the cleanup methods, and it was just on and on and on. And it took about a year or more?
Yeah, maybe 18 months.
Yeah, about a year and a half. And I'll never forget it. He came down the hall with an 8.5 by 11 with a graph on it, and he said it worked. And we knew at that point that this was something that nobody had ever done before. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the aha moment. And we knew from that point that this was going to be a fundable research line.
These kind of interviews are fun to talk about because it allows us to go back in time and think about mm-hmm. all of the hurdles that we had to kind of overcome. And so this isn't a matrix that we can just get off the shelf, right? I can't go to the local stream and, you know, collect water or fish or anything like that. This is a monumental effort. If it's a recent strandium enamel, it takes a huge amount of work for people to go and get that plug back. If it's, you know, even going to convince a museum that we want to have a destructive technique on one of their samples or part of their collection, that's also a big hurdle. So we've developed not only analytical techniques, but collaborations and frameworks of communities to help us to collect and then ship us and have access to those samples. And there's been a lot of – that's just not a challenge that, you know, that you often get to describe, mm-hmm. but logistically it was a massive hurdle. And so even just this, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were in Ottawa and came across a museum there and an outstanding colleague and was able to look at, you know, over 3,000 earplugs, close to 4,000 earplugs, and go through and pick some of the best of the best and are having those shipped back. And we're going to ship back around 100 of those plugs. And so things are really moving and going on, but it took a lot of legwork to get those up. A lot of analytical challenges, a lot of you know, one of the things is this earplug, it's, you know, a lot of those are very small masses. So if we consume all the mass up in one analytical measurement, then we can't, you know, reduces our ability to do future measurements. And so we keep having to take these techniques and refine them down to use less and less mass so that we can do stable isotopes, so we can do metals, so we can do organics, so we can do hormones, and we keep adding to this. And now we're looking at even things like DNA. So we want to be able to put all of this type of information together. And this is really what's going to help us to stay competitive and to be the leaders of this field that we've, you know, actually developed.
Well, the big challenges for science at this point right now are looking at cumulative stressors in the marine environment. And we're actually probably the only group can do this with baleen whales. So it's been very fulfilling in that regard also.
This is Baylor Connections. We are visiting today with Dr. Stephen Trumbull and Dr. Sasha Yusenko talking about their research in whale earwax. And up to this point, we've been talking, although some of it, there's some overlap here in your 2013 study, and now a new one is out that has eventually been receiving some really good attention nationally from NPR, from The Atlantic, and others, reconstructing baleen whales' lifetime response to stressors like whaling and other man-made environmental factors. Obviously, seems like a natural extension of your prior work. What are some of the things you were looking for in this study?
So with the stress work, we've continued to, like Sasha said, he mentioned that we're trying to get all the analytes we can from each layer. And so stress is a big one. And we've been funded to look at the stress and the stressors pertaining to these animals. And once we kind of identified baselines and we put these, we see interesting patterns. And at that point, you're like, what are the patterns caused from, right? And so one of the big arguments and issues right now is if ocean sound or ocean noise contributes to the stress of these animals. Pretty difficult to go back in time and get data from the Navy pertaining to ocean noise or ocean sound. And so we kind of reached out to some colleagues and we said, well, we found this paper from Roca and Phil Clapham, who's a collaborator with us, who's in the International Whaling Commission. Kind of said, oh, you might want to look at this. And then we looked at the whaling data, and we plotted it out, and it seemed to be a really nice correlation there, association. So we kind of used that as kind of the basis for this paper. And the interesting thing is that whaling kind of encompasses this whole thing. I mean, you have direct harvest, you have sound, you have ship proximity, you have hassle, harassment.
Anything that could cause stress.
Absolutely. So, you know, we say whaling, but, you know, we can't really, like, you know, pick out the smaller parts of this. But anyway, so this was kind of the, you know, we were very excited to see this. It you know, with all research, it brings up, 15 more questions, right? So now we're trying to kind of like go back and like figure out if we can like actually like figure out what it is, you know, more specifically. Mm-hmm. And then going forward, getting more samples, if, you know, if there's some climate issues, if there's diet issues, prey issues. And this is all kind of, you know, we're getting more and more into the modeling situation, which is not our forte. So we're bringing in other people, as collaborators. And one of the really nice things about this, because it's such a unique study, people are coming to us, you know, top mm-hmm. people in the field, and they're like, well, can we work with you guys? And so that's really nice also.
That's great. Sasha?
Yeah, this, I mean, the first paper was a proof of concept. Hey, we can do this. And the second paper is showing the power of what we can do with this tool. And, you know, the whaling, I think most people would be like, no surprise that that's a stressful scenario. And we often think of it as being kind of the survivor stress. It's the individuals that survived the whaling. And so, yeah, sound can travel huge distances in the ocean. And you know, one of the things that, that really popped up with is that when we compared the whaling counts, the annual whaling counts versus the compiled annual stress we saw in the kind of the ocean systems, we were able to describe a huge percentage of the variability was explained with whaling. So if we saw an increase in whaling, we saw an increase in stress. Mm-hmm. And in fact, once we saw the Marine Mammal Protection Act coming involved in 1972, a huge decrease in the whaling effort, and that followed by a dramatic decrease in the stress. And so it really showed us that if we continue to have stress on these animals, there continue to be stress. They don't get used to it. And if we help them, if we remove that stress, then they actually respond quite well. One of the interesting things that kind of popped out was right around the 1940s, 1945 time period, we saw a massive decrease in actually whaling, one of our lowest whaling point times from 1900 to the 1970s. One of the lowest point was actually during the wartime, World War II.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw a massive drop in this in the whaling, but we saw an increase in stress. And when we step back and think about whaling being a proxy for this, all these other contributions of stress, you know, or being a circuit for all these other types of stress, you know, proxy, noise, and that type of stuff. And then you think about what would World War II look mm-hmm. like in a ocean system. You've got bombs and, you know, ship activities and torpedoes going off and all this type of pollution and man-made activity at these kind of hyper levels. And we saw that, you know, those ocean systems respond to it. And one of the exciting things is that whales are often considered sentinels of the ocean environment. And so I think the earplug actually allows us to kind of give them, you know, quantitative measurement to that sentinel activity. So we saw that we ramped up our human activities in oceans and they responded. And that wasn't associated with whaling. So we know that whaling is not the only stressor that we see out there. But so it did raise a bunch of other questions. You know, what was the main drivers of the World War II activities? Obviously, the Navy would be interested in that. Of course, we're not doing a lot of whaling activities, kind of this commercial whaling activities anymore. So that's been pretty much dropping off. But one of the interesting things that we're seeing just the recent 4 or 5 decades has been kind of a significant increase in stress within the ocean systems, within these whales. And so even though we removed the whaling, and of course we're not have World War II anymore, we're still seeing their stress increase. And it's at a level now that is comparable to the stress that they were under during whaling activity. So makes us really kind of question what's going on now. What is the major stress that's impacting our ocean systems?
Like you said, 15 other questions. You can go back now and try to figure out what that's from, Steve.
Well, that's the goal. I mean, you know, we're working with the limited, you know, so the Marine Mammal Protection Act was signed in 1972, went into effect. And so getting earplugs past that time period is very difficult. So our sample size is pretty small, and we're kind of working with stranding networks and other agencies to kind of bolster that so we can get better profiles from more recent times. Yeah, it's a conundrum. We have lots and lots of plugs from the 60s and 70s. So going back in time is pretty simple, straightforward. The new data is very important, and we're increasing that. And that's kind of one of our goals right now, is just increase the sample size moving forward. Tons and tons of questions. It's going to take a lot of work. And this is a research line that's, I don't really ever see an end in sight. It's just going to keep moving.
Well, looking forward as we wind down here, we've got just a couple moments left on the program. Is there a burning question of what's next for you all? I mean, you could go a lot of different directions, as you said, but is there a what's next that we can say right now?
We're doing a bunch of like I said, we keep adding various biomarkers and whatnot. We have students working on looking at epigenetics, looking at questions of DNA methylation through time. For a single animal, it's unheard of. Go ahead. What do you got here?
Yeah, we keep pushing the field and the analytical measurement, so we're bringing more colleagues in, bringing in the modeling component, which is definitely going to be helpful. And then we want to answer some of the questions of what's going on the last 30, 40 years. And we have environmental change happening. We have sea surface temperature change in different regions. And there's going to be actually region-specific questions. We're seeing pollution showing up in different parts of the world's oceans. That's an important concept. We didn't know that information before. But these chemical measurements we're moving into understanding more about the population of the whales, and we're moving more into understanding about the primary productivity of the ocean, or this kind of base of the ocean life, or the base of the ecosystem. And those are going to be some really important questions that right now the scientific community is really desperate to get after.
We'll look forward to seeing more of that. And guys, congratulations on this latest paper and the attention it's been receiving. We'll look forward to seeing more of what you have in store for us in the months and years ahead. Thank you very much. And thanks for joining us today during this busy stretch. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Derek.
Thank you.
Dr. Stephen Trumbull and Dr. Sasha Yusinko, our guests today on Baylor Connections. I'm Derek Smith. A reminder, you can hear this and other programs online, baylor.edu/connections, and you can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks for joining us on Baylor Connections.